Campus FM presents Classic Texts, produced by Vicky Spiteri, presented by Margaret Ajus.
Hello and welcome to Classic Texts. As in previous weeks, we will go through a light-footed presentation of a Victorian work of literature. I'm Margaret Ajus, and this week's choice is The Grapes of Wrath by John Steinbeck. Written out of indignation, this is the story of a bitter harvest of self-knowledge and pride ripening in a climate of indifference, ruthless capitalism and casual inhumanity. Steinbeck wrote The Grapes of Wrath after visiting the camps of migrant workers who made their way from drought-stricken Oklahoma to find work in California. During the long rainy season in February 1938, Steinbeck saw thousands of people starving and knew he had to speak out. When the book was first published, it attracted enormous attention, not least from the big farmers, who accused Steinbeck of lies, misrepresentation, and even of being a communist. Steinbeck hated what he called the hysteria, and did not accept that he had written a subversive novel. The message to his readership, however, was clear. The novel opens with a description of drought and dying cornfields. A thick dust whipped up by a windstorm has settled on everything. The people wait, wondering what to do. Meanwhile, Tom Joad, just out of jail for killing a man, is making his way home. He meets Casey, an ex-preacher, and together they walk back to the Joad's place. They find both house and land deserted. The tenant farmers have been evicted by the landowners, and many of them have pegged up to move west. Tom discovers his family are staying with his Uncle John and have bought an old truck for their journey. The Joads and Casey set out on Highway 66 in their burned-out, overladen vehicle with barely enough money to last the trip. Their precarious life on the road is fraught with tragedy, but it has many a moment of humour and comradeship. Before they reach California, both Grandpa and Grandma have died, while the eldest son decides to stay in Arizona. Physically and emotionally exhausted, Ma Joad urges the rest of the family on across the desert to the promised land. They soon have to face up to the scarcity of work and are forced to stay in squatter camps on the outskirts of towns. All around them is rich and fertile land owned by a handful of businessmen interested only in maximizing their profits. The Joads are lucky enough to get a place at a well-organized government camp which is run on the basis of communal responsibility. Kindness and friendship and washrooms make the camps their best experience so far in California. But the lack of work means they must move on. They stop for a few days to pick peaches in place of pickers who are on strike, but the rate is halved as soon as the strike is smashed, and they move on again. Tom's quick temper again lands him in trouble with the law, and he is forced to live as a fugitive. But his anger develops into righteous indignation that encompasses the troubles of people beyond his own immediate family. In defense of the controversial end of the Grapes of Wrath, Steinbeck wrote to a friend in 1939, "I tried to write this book the way lives are being lived, not the way books are written." The novel is a slice of realism in fictional form, written to expose the plight of people like the Joads, who fall victim to greedy landowners. The following audio clip is taken from the 20th Century Fox 1967 film adaptation of Steinbeck's novel, directed by Daryl Zanuck.
Where's my folks, Muley?
Why, they gone.
I know they're gone, but where are they gone? It's Muley Graves. You remember the preacher, don't you?
I ain't no preacher anymore.
All right, you remember the man, don't you?
Glad to see you again.
Glad to see you.
No, where are my folks?
They gone. They gone to your Uncle John's, the whole crowd of them, 2 weeks ago. But they can't stay there either, because John's got his notice to get off.
Well, what happened? How come they gotta get off? We lived here 50 years, same place.
Everybody's gotta get off. Everybody's leaving, going out to California. Your folks, my folks, everybody's folks. Everybody except me. I ain't getting off.
Who done it?
Listen. That's some of what done it. The dusters. They started anyways. Blowing like this year after year. Blowing the land away. Blowing the crops away. Blowing us away now.
You crazy?
Some say I am. You want to hear how it happened?
That's what I'm asking, ain't it?
Well, the way it happens, the way it happened to me, a man come one day.
Back to the matter, Muley. After what them dusters done to the land, the tenant system don't work no more. They don't even break even, much less show a profit. Why, one man in a tractor can handle 12 or 14 of these places. You just pay him a wage and take all the crop.
Yeah, but we couldn't do on any less than what our share is now. Well, the children ain't getting enough to eat as it is. And they're so ragged. We'd be ashamed if everybody else's children wasn't the same way.
I can't help that. All I know is I got my orders. They told me to tell you to get off, and that's what I'm telling you.
You mean get off my own land?
Now, don't go to blaming me. It ain't my fault.
Whose fault is it?
You know who owns the land, the Shawnee Land and Cattle Company.
And who's the Shawnee Land and Cattle Company?
It ain't nobody. It's a company.
They got a president, ain't they? They got somebody who knows what a shotgun's for, ain't they?
Oh, son, it ain't his fault because the bank tells him what to do.
All right. Where's the bank?
Tulsa. What's the use of picking on him? He ain't nothing but the manager. And he's half crazy himself trying to keep up with his orders from the east.
Then who do we shoot?
Brother, I don't know. If I did, I'd tell you. I just don't know who's to blame.
Well, I'm right here to tell you, mister, there ain't nobody gonna push me off my land. My grandpa took up this land 70 years ago. My pa was born here. We was all born on it. And some of us was killed on it.
And some of us died on it. That's what makes it iron. Being born on it and working on it and dying on it. And not no piece of paper with a writing on it.
What happened?
They come. They come and pushed me off. They come with the cats.
What?
The cats. The caterpillar tractors. And for every one of them,
there was 10, 15 families thrown right out of their homes. 100 folks, and no place to live but on the road. The Rances, the Peterses, the Perrys, the Joneses, one right after the other, they got thrown out. Half the folks you and me know, thrown right out into the road.
The novel has an unusual structure. It alternates between descriptive and narrative chapters. It opens with a general description of the Dust Bowl and moves on to Tom's journey in the truck, breaking off to describe a land turtle's tremendous struggle to continue its own journey. The movements of the Joad family are given a wider perspective by the short intervening chapters of commentary and general description. It is in these chapters that Steinbeck's voice comes through most directly. Like a great 19th century novelist, he is unafraid to make direct comment about his characters and the society in which they live. The Grapes of Wrath has amazingly vivid dialogue, making the characters spring to life. The language is potent and earthy and brings an emphatic realism to the text. Humour, sexual humour in particular, plays a large part in the vernacular, while the style and structure underline the main concerns of the novel. The humour and deliberate repetition of language echo the unfailing desire of the human spirit to survive. Casey, a preacher turned philosopher, is very much the mouthpiece for Steinbeck's views on the importance of the relationship between human beings and the natural world. Casey decides the best thing he can do with his life is to stay close to the earth and learn from the natural rhythms of human existence. People's connection with the land is a central theme of the novel. The Joad family and countless others like them have lived as tenant farmers for generations on the poor land around Salizo, working it as best they can, living close to nature, close to poverty. With the drought, the profit margin of the landowners can no longer sustain the tenants and the community is smashed. The further ordinary people get away from the land, the more the system breaks down. Utility farming with its huge acreage and machinery brings a death to the land. Casey believes that the only way the hundreds of thousands of migrants can survive is if they organize themselves as a working force. On a more immediate level, the Joads are able to survive the hardships and privations they face because of their generosity of spirit. They even manage to show kindness to other folk worse off than themselves. Mar Joad has a theory that the hard times are simply a part of human existence and that people will survive, no matter how hopeless the future appears. Shunning publicity and the encumbrances of success, John Steinbeck devoted himself to his work, to understanding the inner man, to fighting, in his life as in his writing, for the causes he believed in. In so doing, In championing the poor, the unemployed, the persecuted, he created fiction which assured him a well-deserved place in the ranks of America's greats. The Nobel Prize in 1962 acknowledged the greatness that his readers had recognized for decades. Steinbeck learned that he had won the 1962 Nobel Prize for Literature from a breakfast television news report. When he later faced reporters, he answered a brash question as to whether he felt he deserved the prize. "Frankly, no," answered Steinbeck. His reply was the level-headed assessment of an honest man, whose ego rarely got in the way of his judgment. Though a writer by nature, inclination, and ambition, he had done so many other jobs, seen so many aspects of life other than the artistic one, that his own literary achievements did not seem momentous to him. And shyness made the role of celebrity thoroughly unwelcome. Born in California on February 27, 1902, to a respectable background, he was socially awkward and reclusive. He had a gift of telling stories, and from his early teens he determined to become a writer. He was admitted to Stanford University, California in 1919, fiercely resistant to academic discipline, working only on what he enjoyed, and teetering on the edge of failure for much of his academic life. He attended classes but never took a degree. The rest of the time he worked at a series of jobs on ranches and fruit farms and in sugar factories, learning as much from the poor Mexicans with whom he lived as from his privileged classmates. This dual education gave Steinbeck the remarkable sympathy and breadth of perception that distinguished his work. Out in the fields and factories, his heart went out to the ignorant and deprived. Already a competent writer, his first newspaper assignment in New York was a disaster when he got sacked for incompetence. He probably contributed more to New York as a laborer working on the construction of Madison Square Gardens. Steinbeck retreated to California working as a caretaker and completed his first novel, Cup of Gold, published in 1929. And while working on a nearby fish hatchery, he met Carol Henning, whom he married. Steinbeck wrote fiction, supported by his father, who admired his determination. In 1931, he began a lifelong and affectionate relationship with the firm of McIntosh and Otis literary agents. Through these two enlightened women, he found publishers for two more novels. And during the next two difficult years, when both his mother and father died, he wrote a book that brought him money and notoriety. For the rest of his life, he would be both solvent and famous. Tortilla Flat was a light-hearted treatment of the Mexican Californians whom Steinbeck knew so well, and the book became a bestseller. Fame, according to Steinbeck, was a pain in the ass, and unlike many writers, he meant it. Resisting the temptation to lay aside his pencils and become a zoologist, he wrote in quick succession three novels, upon which his reputation securely stands: In Dubious Battle, Of Mice and Men, and The Grapes of Wrath. These were all books about destitute people, people with whom Steinbeck deeply sympathized, although his understanding was misinterpreted on all sides. Farm owners and conservative politicians thought him a Marxist subversive, while the intellectual left vilified him for stopping short of communist commitment. Such was the abuse and controversy surrounding The Grapes of Wrath that Steinbeck rejoiced when it finally slipped from the bestseller list. John found a new love in Gwendolyn Conger, a professional singer, and married her in 1943. Meanwhile, he weathered an avalanche of success when his novels became dramatized and filmed in Hollywood. His two children were born in 1944 and 1946. He loved the idea of them and had a romantic notion of their merits, but in reality, they interrupted his work, and he was probably a less than perfect father. Meanwhile, his marriage was under strain from fame, separation, and the couple's homeless wartime existence. Steinbeck described World War II with typical detachment, part of a species pattern, he called it, but threw himself into the war effort with enthusiasm. He wrote a story and screenplay, Bombs Away, in praise of the Air Force. Steinbeck married for the third time in 1950. During the 50s, then, Steinbeck turned to journalism. So when the Nobel Prize came in 1962, it was a bolt from the blue. On December 20th, 1968, he died of heart failure.
We finally got a chance to meet. Yeah. Hello, hello, San Francisco, yeah. We finally got a chance to meet. I knew someday that I baby left me in Chicago in the year 1960. You know when he left me, He said he headed towards the Golden Gate. Name is Betty Jo. She's this big time alone.
running game down on Old Field Road. Somebody tell me where this tree can be found. If I find my baby there, I'm gonna burn Fillmore District down. Yes, I am gonna back to Chi-Town, and I'm gonna back where I belong. Oh yeah. Bye, San Francisco. I'm gonna leave this old West Coast alone.
We have come to the end of another program in the series Classic Texts. Credits go to the Great Writers Magazine for the script and to the AV Library at the CCT University of Malta. Join us again next week for another program in the series.
You have just listened to Classic Texts, produced by Vicky Spiteri, presented by Margaret Ajuso.